Can everyone hear me now? All right, great. Well, hi, everyone. My name is Brian Kaplan. I'm the author of The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies. I'm also a blogger for EconLog. I'm a professor of economics at George Mason University. And I just want to start off by asking a few questions that could be extremely embarrassing for me, but I've got to know. All right, so did anyone here actually read my book? Anyone? A couple of you. All right, so good to know. Did anyone here, has anyone here actually heard of my book before? Like, oh, all right. So now I have some understanding of why you're here. Okay. Let's see. By the way, has anyone read a book by James Surowiecki called The Wisdom of Crowds? Okay. All right. So now the pieces are starting to fall into place. So the guy who invited me said that there would be a lot of fans of James Surowiecki, and my job would be to criticize James Surowiecki. So if that's what you're here for, I will do that for you, although slightly indirectly, although we can go back to the actual direct complaints in a little bit. All right. So just to start off with basically with the background behind my book, if you go and talk to social scientists and ask them how much do voters know about policy, how much they know about politics, how much they know about economics, there is actually a standard answer. And the standard answer is not much. Right. So this is not a controversial question. There's very few people who have ever looked at the data and come back saying the average voter knows what's going on. Right. Not a common view. But still, strangely, there are many people who deny that it matters. There's many people who deny that it actually matters, which I'd say on the surface is pretty counterintuitive. If you were to meet your surgeon who's going to perform brain surgery on you and you start asking him, so what's inside my head anyway? He said, I don't know, like stuff, whatever. So there's some goo inside. I'm going to cut you up and see if that works. You'd probably be nervous because you think, look, the guy doesn't know what he's doing, so he's not going to be able to do it well. Right. So that is a common intuition. Now, if you've read James Surowiecki's book, The Wisdom of Crowds, you know that's not necessarily true. It is actually possible for a group of people in particular who know very little about a subject to actually have a very sensible average view. Right. So Surowiecki gives a number of examples. He has this very famous one about guessing the weight of an ox. There was a contest to guess the weight of an ox around 1900 in Britain, kind of like a contest to guess the number of jelly beans in a jar. And the surprising result was that even though individuals are not very good at guessing the weight of an ox, I don't know, I wouldn't be very good at doing that. Nevertheless, the average guess was only off by about a pound. And moreover, the average guess was better than any individual guess, right? Which may seem very odd, and yet it worked. And in Surowiecki's book, he goes over a number of other examples. And the important thing to realize is Surowiecki's view is not that unusual among people who study politics. So among people who study politics, there's many people long before Surowiecki who have basically made the same defense, saying, look, you may go and talk to people who are about to vote and get very distressed because it seems like they have no idea what's going on. However, that may not make any difference at all. Maybe the system works just fine. Let's see. So just to give you an example that I like, just imagine that you've got a world where 98% of the people know absolutely nothing about politics. So they, if they actually make up their mind by flipping a coin, and on the other end, the 2% know everything that's going on. Now, imagine that you've got an election between the Unabomber. Anyone remember the Unabomber? Anyone read his manifesto? Yes, it's entertaining, well written. So in any case, but a key part of the manifesto is getting rid of all advanced technology, which he admits will reduce human population to a few million people. But he says we've got to do it because it's just inhuman to keep living the way that we're doing, as you're doing here. Right? What you're doing is inhuman. You need to be hunting for your food. All right. So anyway, if you were to have this guy running against some normal person who does not favor extermination of almost the entire human race, and you had this election between 98% of the people who know zero, 2% of people who know everything that's going on. Well, there's 98% of people have no idea what's going on, so they're going to vote by flipping a coin, in which case you may get very distressed to find out that a guy who favors the extermination of the human race can get 49% of the vote, which is worse than any election that you may have heard about. On the other hand, though, if you assume that knowledgeable people would not vote for the guy who favors extermination, then not only will the non-Unabomber get 49% of the uninformed vote, he'll also get all 2 percentage points of the informed vote, which adds up to 51%. And here you get this nice result that the winner of the election is exactly the same person who would have won if everyone were fully informed. Right? So the winner of the election is exactly the same person who would have won if everyone were fully informed. This is the kind of result that you see in Surowiecki's book many times, where even though most people don't know what's going on, still the law of large numbers protects us from danger. The law of large numbers saves us because when you have a whole bunch of people who don't know what's going on, they basically flip a coin. Those people balance each other out. And the small number of people who actually understand what's happening are enough to tip the scale in favor of the outcome that you would have gotten if everyone knew what he's doing. Right. Now, among academics, this outcome has a name. This is called the miracle of aggregation. Right. So this is basically like medieval alchemy, where you go and you get 98% lead and you pour it into a vial, then you put in a couple drops of gold, 2% gold, and you shake it up and you put a cloth over it and say some magic words, pull it off, and it's 100% gold. Right. That seems quite miraculous. And of course, in chemistry, as far as my limited understanding goes, that would be miraculous. But if you're talking about social decisions, it actually follows logically from the assumptions. Right? You can actually show that as long as there's a reasonably large number of people, you will actually get the same outcome that you would have gotten if everyone were fully informed. Now, if there were only three voters, you should actually be nervous. Right? If there are three voters and it's an election between the Unabomber and the normal guy, then there's actually a 1 in 4 chance that coin flipping will lead the other two to vote for the Unabomber, and then you'll be outvoted, and that will be the end of you. I guess if there are only three, maybe you could survive on a hunter-gatherer level, but it's a basic idea. Okay, so a highly uninformed electorate can act as if it were perfectly informed. And again, if you've read Sir Wiki's book, he goes over a lot of other examples. So you may remember the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire example, where if you go with whatever answer, the most popular answer is among the audience is almost always right. Of course, he talks about betting markets, a number of other examples that you may be familiar with. It is a very good book, so you can learn a lot from it. Or this, he also talks about financial markets. Then he has, you know, some other interesting cases involving like locating a submarine and just taking an average of the views of different people and being able to find the submarine there. So on. Now, what's interesting about this miracle of aggregation is that it gives people a way to believe that democracy works despite the public's blatant cognitive deficiencies. So it gives people a way to believe in democracy and the facts at the same time. And like walking and chewing gum at the same time. And for academics who study democracy, this is a big and very comforting result. Because on the one hand, if you have seen the data, you don't want to go against it and say that up is down and that voters do know a lot of what's going on. But on the other hand, the story tells you, you know, it really doesn't matter. We can stop worrying about the fact that if you just go and quiz voters waiting to vote, they have no clue. All right. So any questions before we go on? Let's see. So I guess this is supposed to be interactive. So it can be, if you go to a seminar of economists, which probably most of you do regularly, like me, economists have a culture of interrupting at any time. So if you want to do that, feel free. On the other hand, if you want to let me escape to a realm where people are a little bit more polite, that's okay too. All right. Now, anyway, so far so good. The main reaction I have to this is, well, if this seems to be too good to be true. There's an old saying, if something seems to be too good to be true, it probably is. Anyone here watch late night television and see ads for you too can open your own alpaca farm? Anyway, in Virginia, they're trying to get us to open alpaca farms. And, you know, apparently, any person can just go and send a few $1,000 to the people who are running this commercial and they will deliver an alpaca to you or two, hopefully. And pretty soon you'll be breeding them and they're wonderful, friendly animals and their fur is so soft. And you too will have a thriving alpaca farm, which you can do anywhere according to them. And you know, as I watch this, I think, you know, this seems too good to be true. It's just hard to believe that I could send a few $1,000 and become a successful alpaca farmer with such great ease. Again, maybe I'm just being very close-minded or I underestimate myself, don't realize that I have a knack for alpaca farming and everyone else does too, apparently. But I would say, you know, even though I've never actually looked into this, I'm just automatically skeptical of that a story like this could actually work out. And this is very much my reaction to many of the stories that you get in Sir Wiki's book. Not that the examples are bad. The examples seem to be fine as far as they go. But my main criticism is just that there isn't a very strong hunt for counterexamples. I mean, there's not a lot of attention saying, well, you know, here's some cases where it works. Or, you know, what are the cases where it does not work? Are there any examples where we can find this? And again, you know, this is just Sir Wiki. But also if you go to social scientists who work in this area, you very much get the same result, or actually there I'd say it's worse. So you have many social scientists who just do mathematical modeling, who don't actually look at facts at all, who say it's possible this could work, and then build their career on that. And again, that seems to be very poor social science. It seems like part of science is actually testing ideas against facts, and this is something that in fact you could test. So when I began this project, sort of looking into, you know, what evidence is there that the assumption of coin flip error is true? What evidence is there that people who don't know very much basically flip a coin to decide what to do or what to think? And I say it turns out that there's surprisingly little evidence this is so. But in fact, when you go to public opinion data, it is easy to find counterexamples. In fact, if you just start at random, most of what you find will be nothing but counterexamples. And so you really do have to cherry pick the examples in order to find ones where errors do conveniently balance out. And otherwise, it's quite easy to find that it generally does not. So to quickly give you some ways that you might go about this, the easiest and most straightforward thing is to say, all right, look, let's start with a question that has a definite quantitative answer, like the percentage of the U.S. budget that's spent on foreign aid. And you can find out the answer to this question by going to the government budget and find the lines that involve foreign aid, add them up. You come up to about 1.2% of the federal budget. Then you go and you do a phone survey. You get Gallup to call people and say, what do you think the percentage of the budget spent on foreign aid is? And you'll generally get an answer that is not on average 1.2%. In fact, you'll get an answer that is not, it's not 1.3%, it's not 2%. You'll generally get an answer like 10, 20%. Right? An enormous fraction of the budget is believed by people to be spent on foreign aid, even though that's simply not true. Right? And again, just to give you an idea about how severe this bias is, there was one survey done by the Kaiser Family Foundation where they actually asked people to say, well, what are the two biggest areas of the federal budget? They gave them a list of six items. Foreign aid was the most frequently named of all. 41% of Americans said that it was one of the two biggest items. And on the other hand, Social Security was way down the list, which of course is actually the biggest item. So that's one thing you can do, and we can learn a lot from that. And in fact, we can say, wow, counterexamples are everywhere to this claim that errors conveniently balance out. There's some other approaches that you can do. Since we don't have that much time, I'll just skip the one that I do. And this is what I call the method of comparing laymen and experts. All right, so here I begin with a very elitist presumption, but notice I only say presumption. I don't say dogma. I don't say absolute truth, just presumption. And here's the presumption. When a layman and an expert disagree, the expert is probably right. When a layman and an expert disagree, the expert is probably right. How can you say that? Isn't that elitist? Yeah, I guess it is elitist. All right, doesn't mean that it's wrong. All right, now, there are plenty of cases where you may say, well, can you always trust the experts? No, of course you can't. Right? There are some very specific cases where you might have reasoned out the experts, like you go to get your car repaired. The expert says it's going to cost $1,000 to fix. And you may say, I don't believe you. And you say, why? I'm the expert. You do know more about cars than me. However, it is also in your interest to tell me a number that is much higher than the truth. Okay, so that's a case where you might reasonably doubt the expert. What if the expert knows that you're not getting the work done at his shop? Then it starts to seem a little bit paranoid to think that he's making up these numbers just to screw with you. And then suppose that this is your son who's telling you this, your son, the mechanic, who, again, you've treated your son well. He has no grudge against you and tells you that your car is going to take $1,000 of work. This is a case where it seems like you'd have to be really paranoid, dogmatic, and arrogant to say, what the hell do you know? Which is basically what my dad tells me all the time when we talk about economics, which is, what do you know about this? I study it for many, many years. I don't know. Doesn't that count for anything? No. So your prophet hath no honor in his own country. So, all right. So anyway, my presumption is that when laymen and experts disagree, the experts are probably right. And in my book, while this is a very general principle, but I focus on beliefs about economics for a couple of reasons. One of them is I am an economist. So, and again, yeah, I have economist pride. So I have nerd pride and I have economist pride. I'm proud to be a nerd. I'm proud to be an economist. But I don't think that would get anyone else to be interested. So I'll also say that it is a very strong rule that when you ask the American public what is the most important issue facing the country, they will generally say the economy. After 9/11, there was a period when they started to say foreign policy. Now it might be Iraq, I'm not sure. But overall, over the last 30 years, it is almost always the economy. So it's not just economists who think the economy is important. Almost everyone thinks the economy is important. Okay. And finally, I'll say that this is a good story just because economists, probably more than any other profession, have a many century long tradition of complaining about their students. Right now, of course, I'm sure physics professors complain about their students too, saying the students are so lazy, they don't do their homework. But economists' complaint is very different. Economists complain, the students show up on day one and say, look, let me tell you, professor, let me tell you how the economy really works. Right. And this is unusual. You don't usually go to physics class on day one and say this. You don't usually go to stats class, logic class. So again, economists are complaining about this. Now, of course, you may say, well, the reason is because economics is a bogus field to begin with. So the students are right. Right. So possibly. But still, I'll say that the student's attitude has been enough to provoke economists to complain about this. And the complaint is basically that students show up thinking they already have the answers. It's not that students show up having no views, not knowing basic facts, not having much interest in the field. It's that they show up having an interest, and their interest leads them to say, I've already got it all figured out, without ever having opened the textbook. Okay. All right. So economists have been complaining about the public's misconceptions about economics for several centuries. So I think this also makes it an interesting story. It says, look, is there actually any basis in fact for these complaints, or are economists just making this up? Or other possibilities, the students say this on purpose just to bother us. So the students say, professor, the best thing of all is if we didn't trade with Japan anymore, because then we'd be much richer because we'd have more jobs. Right. And then, maybe the student is thinking, hi, no, this is really bothering him. Of course, it's false, but I just want to see his reaction. So, all right. Another possibility. All right. Now, the strategy that I use in this book is I found a data set called the Survey of Americans and Economists on the Economy, which really was a fantastic set of data for my purposes. This is the only survey that actually deliberately asks both the general American public and PhD economists exactly the same questions about how the economy works. Yes. The Survey of Americans and Economists on the Economy is done by the Kaiser Family Foundation, Washington Post, and Harvard University Survey Project. So, of course, there's been lots of other surveys about what economists think about the economy, what non-economists think, but they've never asked the same groups the same questions. So it's always open for someone to say that it's just due to question, just because you asked the question differently. As you may know from polling, it is often possible to change people's answers by changing the way you ask the question. Like you say, is this glass half full, half empty? People will give you different answers, even though they're logically equivalent. So there is always this concern. Okay. All right. So when you actually get the highest quality data surround that actually allows us to compare apples to apples, does the miracle of aggregation work? Of course, I wouldn't be here if the answer were yes. No, the answer is no. The miracle of aggregation fails, and it fails very badly. And it fails in the direction that economists complaining would lead you to expect. Okay, so the informal complaining about economists saying, I can't believe my students think this stuff. They're so dogmatic. They show up thinking they've got it all figured out, and they don't. This actually does fit with the patterns. And moreover, these are not small effects that you can only pick up with very advanced statistics. Instead, these are the kinds of patterns that just leap out of the data. Okay, so there are very large belief gaps. Now, if we had many hours and if I wanted to make everyone leave the room, I would go over all 37 questions and each and every result. I have gotten a few reviewers saying the whole book is so readable except for the chapter where he goes over the data. Right. That chapter used to be about twice as long. So it was made substantially less unreadable, but still in the end, you may find yourself skipping. But just to tell you what the basic belief gaps that you can find are between economists and the public. Let's see. One of them is what I call anti-market bias, which is a systematic tendency for the general public to underestimate the social benefits of the market mechanism. So it's a tendency to underestimate the social benefits of the market mechanism. There's many examples around us that you can see. Talk about a weird example, because I've told that this is a very hip crowd. I've been told this is a very hip crowd. Is this true? Is everyone here hip? Okay. So the market for human kidneys. This is an idea that has support from economists across the entire range of political spectrum, all the way to Marxism. Right. So I've been at a dinner with Marxist economists and said, all right, so what do you guys think about kidney or market for human kidneys? And they will say, great. It's a good idea. I don't really like it as a Marxist, but I got to admit it would save many, many lives. And so I'm going to have to go along with it. Right. So what is the idea about a market for human kidneys? Well, right now there's an enormous list of people who need a kidney. And right in this room, I see a hundred perfectly good kidneys that are being wasted. Right. Because it turns out you don't need your second kidney. As far as I understand, your second kidney is not really insurance for you, because if you get kidney disease, it will generally affect both of your kidneys. And therefore, you don't need one of your kidneys. And there's a whole bunch of people who could use a kidney right now. So, if you don't realize this and you want to do this, you can immediately leave the room and donate the kidney and make a person very happy. However, I suspect not many people will do this, because even if you do find out you don't need this kidney, you don't want to give it to a stranger for free. And that is basically what the law requires right now for a living human kidney donation. Right. So, and on top of this, even worse in terms of there being no incentive to donate to give your kidney when you're alive, there's also lots of perfectly good kidneys that go into the ground with a person because they didn't sign their organ donor card. And again, what could you do about this? Well, if you offered people $50 to sign their organ donor card, how many people might change their minds and says, I guess it's not really so bad to have $50 to have this card. Right. So anyway, the idea of having a market in human kidneys where people are allowed to sell their kidneys to someone who wants them is something that almost all economists think of as a good idea, saying, look, this is a way of saving lives. The people sell their kidneys will be better off by several thousand dollars. And what exactly is the complaint about this supposed to be? So it's again, you can go to, there are a few criticisms of it, but in the end, almost everyone who has gone over the idea says this is really a good idea, and yet almost no non-economist thinks that we should do this. Well, there is the people might kill people for their organs criticism. Actually, I'd say that there's a greater incentive to do it now because essentially the black market price is greater. Just like there's a greater incentive to kill people for cocaine right now than if cocaine were legalized. So that's one. I guess the other one usually comes from bioethicists saying this would lead to a commodification of human life, and since we don't, and then that's worth 70,000 lives. That seems like an awfully abstract reason to let tens of thousands of people die, but. Again, there's no additional thing that an economist can tell you about that. Just to take a much more ordinary example, a while back when I was going to give a talk similar to this, I was driving against an enormous amount of traffic. There's like a 7-mile traffic jam outside of DC. This traffic jam happens every single morning, and this is a problem that every economist in the country knows how to solve, which is raise the price of driving during peak times, right? And that, again, maybe say, that's just a way to get additional money in the pockets of whoever's collecting the tolls. Yeah, it's also a way to greatly reduce commuting times. And moreover, you could, for example, cut other taxes if you were charging people for commuting during peak times. You could reduce taxes on things that are useful, like work, by effectively raising the tax on something that inconveniences others, like driving during peak times. Okay, so those are just a few examples. But these are classic cases of how economists think versus how non-economists think, this does not mean that every economist thinks that we should use the market in every case, but rather that economists do think that the public tends to dismiss the market very hastily, primarily just on the basis that it's about greed. Saying, look, people are being selfish, it's greedy, therefore the social consequences will be bad. Whereas the economist's point is, look, just because people are greedy and selfish does not mean the outcome will be bad. The key thing is, what do you actually have to do to make money? The way that you make money is by making your consumer happy, as in, say, making someone happy by selling them your kidney. Then, in fact, the fact that you have a selfish motivation in selling your kidney does not mean that the result is actually going to be bad for anyone. In fact, it seems to be better for everyone. Let's see. That's a good question. There's a well-known, highly economically literate journalist named Virginia Postrel who actually gave her kidney away. Her picture is actually featured in a textbook of a couple of my colleagues in their market or in a chapter in the textbook. Yes, that is one. Well, here's the thing: it is illegal to sell your kidney. Yes. Yes. Giving away is different. So you can give away, your kidney, and again, you're free to do that. However, that has been very far from enough to actually get people to start handing out anywhere near the number of kidneys that people need to stay alive and get off dialysis. All right. Now, yes. Let's see. I do have many examples, but maybe I should move on. I'll give you one other. Here's one. The cheapest way to clean up pollution. So the kinds of things the public generally wants to do are CAFE standards, where you pass a regulation saying that all cars have to have a certain level of fuel economy. On the other hand, economists have long said, well, you could get a much bigger bang for your buck by just taxing pollution. Right, and I don't have time to go into all the details, but there's very strong results saying that you could get the same level of pollution cleanup for half the price if you did it this way rather than the way that we now do it. Or, of course, you could get maybe double the level of cleanup for the same price. Again, the key point is that some kinds of there's some kinds of carbon that are much cheaper to clean up than others. And if you tell everyone that he has to cut back by 20%, you wind up having some very expensive cleanup and some very cheap cleanup. If you just tax it, then you wind up getting, tax it to a level to get the same level of pollution. You wind up having the people who clean it can clean up the pollution cheaply do it all. Okay, but I probably should move on, but there are many examples that we could go over. But okay, now next big bias, so what I call anti-foreign bias. If people are concerned about markets, they are especially freaked out when foreigners are involved, right? So you're in Texas, close to Mexico, so you probably have a greater level experience with this than even most Americans. But in general, as soon as your economist says, look, when someone from Texas buys something from someone in Virginia, or like when I go and buy some hats for my kids at the Alamo, I'm better off, the people at the Alamo are better off, I guess society's better off. However, people will often start to question this logic if it's an American buying something from China, right? And again, you may say, isn't it basically the same thing? Non-economists think there's an enormous difference, and yet basic economics will tell you there really is not very much difference. very little difference between Americans buying stuff from foreigners and Americans buying stuff from Americans. In both cases, both sides are better off. And again, there are, so what about all the lost jobs? Of course, the key thing here is that countries can and do specialize in the things that they are relatively good at. Again, not to bore everyone, but there is a principle, and you can go to your textbook or Wikipedia on comparative advantage. Basic point is that international trade is something that is mutually beneficial, even if one country is better at everything. Even if one country is better at everything, it still makes sense for countries to specialize in the things that they are relatively good at. Probably the easiest way to explain this is imagine that the world's best brain surgeon is also the world's fastest typist. Would it make sense for him to hire his own to hire a secretary to do his typing? Right. And of course, the answer is yes. Right. Because by hiring that secretary, even though the secretary types more slowly, this frees up his time to do what is more valuable, which is brain surgery. It's like when Americans import goods from countries that have with more low skilled labor, this frees up the time of our higher skilled labor to do things that require a greater level of skill. Okay, so you can see this attitude in international trade. You can see this very much in immigration. Again, let's see. So immigration, I suspect, in Texas is a touchy topic. So again, in the Q&A, we can talk about it a bit more. Just let me put it this way. For virtually every complaint about immigration, there is a lower cost way of dealing with the problem than immigration restrictions. For example, if your complaint is that immigrants reduce the wages of low-skilled Americans, here is a cheaper way of dealing with the problem. How about you have a surtax on the wages of guest workers? And you use that surtax to compensate low-skilled Americans, right? This is a way that you could get the same result of compensating high school dropouts in the U.S. from foreign competition, but at a much lower cost, not only to Americans, but also to the world, right? So just one example. Or again, of course, another one is if the complaint is that immigrants will come and use welfare, then you could, of course, have waiting limits on when you're on eligibility restrictions, so on. This is also something where there are deep public misconceptions about what the actual fiscal costs of immigrants are. It's true that immigrants do tend to be a bit poor, and so they wind up using more government services that are used by the poor. However, there's the basic fact that most redistribution in the U.S. is not towards the poor. It's towards the elderly and also towards women and kids. Right? So when you have a healthy young male immigrant comes, basically there's very few programs that he's eligible for. And interestingly enough, it's actually illegal immigrants who are the best deal of all. Because illegal immigrants generally do not collect any benefits at all, but they often still wind up paying taxes because they have a fake Social Security card. Right? So if you're concerned about the federal, and if you're concerned about the federal budget, actually illegal immigration is a surprisingly good deal. In small measure, again, there is a much cheaper way of getting the same thing. Like I said, you could have a surtax and allow them to come in legally, and then instead of burning up a lot of resources having coyotes smuggle people, you could just go and take that income and redistribute it to take care of whoever you think is suffering from it. Another big bias that you see in the data is what I call make-work bias. This is a tendency to judge the performance of an economy based upon employment rather than production, which is a very natural view until you take a look at the U.S. economy 150 years ago when almost everyone is employed in agriculture and then realize, so what happened? What happened is almost all farmers lost their jobs. And again, it was gradual, but still, as a result of the advancing technology in agriculture, almost all farmers lost their jobs. And what was the result? People did something else. Now, if at the time when farmers were losing their jobs, an economist had come along and said, oh, you just do something else, don't worry about it, you would have seemed like an insensitive jerk. But that doesn't mean that it's not basically true. The reason why the world has changed so much, the reason why, let's see, any farmers in this room? Yeah, one farmer, two farmers. The reason why there's like two farmers in this room instead of like 98 farmers in this room, or more realistically, there'd be no one in this room because we'd be farming instead of going to conferences, is because jobs were destroyed. Right? Jobs were destroyed because we figured out a way to do the same thing with fewer people, and this freed up valuable labor to do something else. Okay. Last bias I talk about in the book is what I call a pessimistic bias. This is this general tendency of the public to think that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, to think that things are getting worse, are bad now, and are going to get even worse in the future. This is so far from true, it almost boggles the mind. When you just look at how much improvement there has been over the last 100 years, the last 200 years, although now I've been alive long enough to even see progress over the last 20 years, so I remember what it was like to be a nerd growing up in the 80s. There was nothing to do. What could you do with your computer? I could program in BASIC. Let me tell you, I had a VIC-20 with 4K of memory. 4K. Do you even remember what K stands for? this computer could do next to nothing. And now, computers are used to do an incredibly wide variety of things. You can go to many other sessions here. And, there's like some session where people are using computers to do their knitting for them or something like that, which I assume this can be easily explained if I know, but, so in any case, this is just one small area of progress. I also was thinking about the number of television stations that were around when I was a kid. It was 3 and then it went to 4. And they were all terrible. All terrible, all terrible reception. Yes. Or you mean relative deprivation? Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, it is true that there is a tendency for people to start taking stuff for granted. Just like probably many of you have had your internet service down for an hour. Like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened in human history. It's just terrible. Certainly, you do have that. I talk about pessimism as thinking that things actually are materially getting worse, which is definitely not right. As for people saying, philosophically, it doesn't really make us happier. There's a fair amount of data suggesting that there's at least quite a bit of truth to that. There's some controversy about whether one possibility is the extra wealth is doing very little for us. Another possibility is there's been other changes that are counterbalancing the effects of extra wealth. So in the end, I'd say there is a lot of truth to the basic point that people tend to have a pretty fixed level of happiness. Which I think about whenever I see like very high stressed out corporate lawyers earning large amounts of money, and you think, well, when they were in law school, they were working just as hard and had almost no money. So if they're miserable now, how miserable must they have been in law school if the money was actually doing much for them? I think there is something to that. Right. Again, this is your point is that, any cause for pessimism is just a basic one about human beings don't appreciate what they have. The world is getting better. Whatever the problem is inside of us, just a lack of appreciation, or maybe failure to take the effort to look around and find things that you like and the things that make you happy. All right, now, big question that I've dodged so far, but now what I addressed is, couldn't it be the experts who are biased? Right, because economists, unlike many other fields of expertise, actually have a whole industry of people who hate us. And again, you may say justifiably. When I say this to economists, people say, "Well, how could anyone hate us? We're so lovable." But there is a whole industry of people who do not like economists, and they will actually make arguments for why economists are actually a bogus field and are not really to be trusted. One story is economists don't agree about anything. This is something that is just not true, and people who actually criticize the field don't say this. People who professionally criticize the field don't say this. Through this is actually a very high level of consensus among economists. As I said, on something like as controversial as human kidneys, you can get everyone from Marxists to libertarians saying that legalizing this market is a good idea. Okay, now when you go to act the critics, the more the complaint is, look, economists go and agree on this stuff that is repugnant to most people. Okay, and for that, there's a lot of truth. There is a lot of truth, no denying it. Okay, so couldn't it be the experts are biased? Well, as long as the complaint is simply the experts are biased, there isn't really any way of showing that's wrong. Right, they say, look, you guys are biased, and why? You just are. Okay, there isn't very much that I can say about that. However, if someone is willing to actually put their cards on the table and say, you're biased and here's why, then it is at least possible to statistically test whether the story holds up. And it turns out that for the two most common stories, not only is it possible, but it's easy. Right, so the number one story that you'll get about why economists are not to be trusted and why they are actually a bogus field of expertise basically says that economists think that whatever is good for them is good for the country, so they have self-serving bias. Let's see, those may be the enemies of economics trying to disrupt the talk, but I will not allow it. All right. So, specifically, people often say, look, economists generally have high incomes, and many of them have tenure. So I have tenure right now. What does tenure mean? It means I have a dream job for life. That's true. All right. So no denying it. But here's the thing. There is actually some variation among economists on this point. And furthermore, there's actually variation on this among the general public. So there are plenty of non-economists who have lives every bit as cushy as a tenured professor. Some of them even better, as hard as that may be to believe. All right. So it is then possible empirically to go and see if we go and make this adjustment, if we go and basically either compare economists with lower income and low levels of job security to non-economists who have lower income and lower levels of job security, or We go and compare economists to members of the general public who have comparable levels of income and job security. Like, suppose we compare typical economists to, not Bill Gates because he's too rich, but I don't know, like three levels down from Bill Gates. If we go and compare, you know, compare those two, what do we find? The big punchline is that you still see a very large belief gap. Essentially, at the most, you could explain about 20% of the very large belief gap by using measures of self-interest, including income, job security, income growth, race, gender, all of these things that you might think would be coloring the perceptions of economists. If you go and compare them to people who are similar in every way, except they haven't studied economics, you still see very large gaps in beliefs. Okay, so that's one story that just doesn't seem to check out. Now, another one, which you can call the story of ideological bias, this story is, look, economists are a bunch of extremely right-wing Republicans, and therefore, of course, they think all this stupid free market stuff, because that, you know, essentially no one would go into the field if they didn't think it, because they would feel like a pariah. Right? So this is something that can be said, however, and actually, if you're at my own department, there would be some justice in this claim. Right. So, yes, George Mason is known as being a very right-wing department, so I do not deny that. However, this data set is not people. I mean, it's not like people in my building. This data set is for the overall economics profession. If you go to the meetings of the American Economic Association, which, you know, I'm sure you'll find much more fun than this conference, you know, you can see famous economists walking down the streets without groupies following them strangely. You know, even Joseph Stiglitz with his Nobel Prize can walk down the street unmolested by anyone. All right. So, Krugman, actually. Wonder. Yeah. I think you could still actually, you know, there might be some graduate students chasing him down, but all right. So anyway, if you go there, you will learn the deep, dark truth, which is that the typical economist is actually a moderate Democrat. Typical economist is a moderate Democrat who wants to legalize the market for human kidneys, who thinks that downsizing is good for the economy, who favors free trade, who favors all these other things that people find repugnant. And in fact, generally, you know, the moderate Democrat did not favor these things before studying economics, but instead what they'll tell you is, you know what? I learned something. Learn something. I can still have these. I can still have the liberal or moderate values that I had when I came in. What I learned is that the best means of pursuing them are not what I originally thought. Okay. So now, when you go and test the story of ideological bias against the data, first of all, you know that it can't hold up because actually, the typical economist is a bit more liberal and democratic than the member of the general public. So actually, the belief gaps get a little bit larger when you make this adjustment. If you go and compare the politically independent, ideologically moderate economist to the politically independent, ideologically moderate member of the public, the gap is even larger than it was before. Okay. Now, just to just to do one more topic. Yeah, we got time. All right. And then, let's see, we're supposed to leave 10 or 15 minutes for questions. All right. I guess I've been talking about people. I can say that, you know, one concern is, well, you're talking about people. What about voters? The answer is that voters are essentially no different from people. Right. Yeah. that's not meant to be flippant, but in other words, the typical person who votes is actually extremely similar to just the typical American. He's actually a little bit more educated, so turns out to have views that are a bit more reasonable than those of the typical American, by a moderate amount. Actually, I am just about to talk a bit about voters, but so maybe not what you wanted me to talk about. Hopefully we can go back to that. All right, now, at the end of it, going all over all these results, I ask a question which is maybe more interesting to economists than to anyone else, but still is worth saying, which is, look, all this may be true in fact, but how is it possible in theory? This is true in fact, but how is it possible in theory? Economists will ask this question, look, I just don't see how it could be possible. And if you can't show me how it's possible, I'm not going to believe the facts. Right, on one hand, you can say this is pretty dogmatic, but it's not as crazy as it seems. If you see a helium balloon, anyone inclined to say gravity is refuted by this balloon. You see it's floating up all on its own. So there is a case where you might want to say, maybe I just don't understand the theory well enough. Okay, so my answer here is that you can actually think about irrationality, right? Irrationality as a actual decision to not think very hard, to not be very reasonable, to allow yourself to be emotional about an issue as a way of protecting beliefs from reality. It's irrationality is a way of protecting beliefs from reality. So, here's the bad thing about being rational. Your beliefs are always on the table, right? If as long as you are a reasonable person, you always have to be open to someone going and saying, look, here's some evidence. Have you ever considered this? And maybe you have to change your mind. And, that's a problem. On the other hand, if you don't want to ever have to change your mind, just don't be rational. Right? You say, look, I don't care. That doesn't mean anything. Those bones were planted by Satan or what have you. And you're fine, right? Your belief is then secure for life. And whatever emotional comfort that belief gives you, you may retain it in perfect security. Okay? All right. So, and again, this is something that I don't think is so hard to believe. People actually have beliefs that mean something to them. If you imagine, how you would feel if you were to start challenging your basic religious views or challenging your basic political views, generally it would probably be an emotionally wrenching experience. Called The God That Failed by former communists, which is where they all describe how they stopped being communists. And not one of them says, I was so happy when I learned that I was wrong, because it's just good to be true, good to be right. None of them said this. Instead, they said it was like emotional hara-kiri. I felt like I wanted to kill myself. My entire world came crashing down because people's lives give them identity, meaning, structure. Right. And then, of course, on top of this, just consider that your friends may judge you for your views, too. How many of your friends or family would be disappointed in you if you announced that you would suddenly change all of your views? See, look, my religious views, I now think the opposite. My political views think the opposite. You might even lose some friends. You might be disowned by your family, possibly, which is another reason not to really ask hard questions. Okay. All right. Now, you can think about irrationality as being a good like any other, which is, you can use it to protect comforting beliefs from reality. And here's the thing. In politics, you pay very little for having irrational beliefs. So if you're a surgeon who likes the comforting belief that you're such a great surgeon, that you may think, I'm such a great surgeon, I'm better drunk than other surgeons are sober. Okay, that's a comforting belief. And you know, I've heard that surgeons are egotistical folks, so not knowing very many, but it's plausible. Right. So you might like to think this. However, if you think this thing, you are going to destroy your career. You're going to have your medical license pulled. You're going to ruin your life. Right. So this is a pleasant but costly belief to hold. And I think very few people actually hold it. On the other hand, if you have really crazy views about the best ways to about the best economic policies, this is something that will actually probably do you no harm in life. Why? Because nobody listens to you. You're just one person out of a country of hundreds of millions in Texas, like tens of millions. So there's just one of you. You have no more than an imperceptible effect on the outcome, and therefore you can really safely believe any crazy view that you want without consequence. Okay, now here's the thing: if one person does this, this is pretty harmless. But if everyone does this, it can be a disaster, right? Which is just like pollution. If one person goes and drives a polluting car, there's not going to be any perceptible effect. No one will ever know the difference. But if everyone on Earth drives a very polluting car, we may do enormous damage to ourselves. Right. The air may be so unpleasant to breathe, like in Mexico City, sometimes that you have to wear a mask. Right? One person driving does not cause this problem. And if you were to tell someone wearing a mask who's driving, why don't you stop driving your car if you don't like the pollution? Because it wouldn't help more than an infinitesimal amount. Okay? So that is the key idea here that I'm making, that there are some areas like politics where you could be completely wrong, and yet the consequences for you as a voter will actually be the same as if you thought something completely different. Right. So here I often think about my dad, who has long had two solutions for all economic problems facing the country. The first is a Berlin Wall at the Mexican border. And the second is a naval blockade of Japan. Although actually he's changing his country, his target country. Now it's China, although maybe all of Asia, just to be safe from anything that might come out of Asia to endanger us. Here's the thing now, if he were to actually go and vote for the candidate that supported these policies, he would not actually be harming himself more than an infinitesimal amount, because again, he's just one person. But if people generally shared his views, then you could actually have a very bad result indeed. Okay, so what I say in the book is that far from actually being inconsistent with economic theory, economists should actually expect people to have crazy views about politics, because it's free, right? You can think this is an area where if you want to get crazy, you can do it on the cheap, right? I think we look around and we see people doing it all the time. Right. So you can see, politics really is the religion of the modern world. You can see people are extremely dogmatic about it. They are very emotional. If you want to get someone upset, just start telling them that their views about politics are wrong. And a lot of people will. So, just in the same way, or probably not as extreme. If you want to make an enemy, start telling someone, look, here are all the reasons why your religion is false. And again, some people make friends like this, but it generally doesn't work so well. All right. So, in other words, this is something where economists distinguishing the private cost and the social cost of something. The private cost of having false beliefs about for a voter having false beliefs about policy are very low. However, the social cost, when you go and multiply them out by all the people who are going to be affected, can be quite substantial. Right? So in other words, suppose you live in a country where everyone else but you has completely idiotic views about economics. The fact that you got an A+ in the class is of no help to you. You're still going to live under the same policy as everyone else, because that is what matters. Yes. That's absolutely right, and that's where the empirics of the book come in, right? So the key point of the empirics is not just that people make mistakes, but that there are strong patterns of mistakes. So I mean that's really, you know, when I was going over the four big biases, there my claim is that there's actually a strong cluster. And what's interesting is that the less people know about economics, the lower level of education, the more likely they are to have these views. Right. So in other words, the actual pattern, based upon, say, Sirwiki, you'd expect the people who know the least would have the most random views. Actually, the people who know the least are often extremely predictable. In the case of international trade, for example, people dropped out of high school are almost invariably protectionists. Almost invariably. And you may say it's just because their income is lower and therefore they know they're competing with low skilled labor around the world. Even if you statistically adjust for this, you can still see this is a very strong pattern. It's not the case that actually their views are random. Instead, it's basically the less you know, the more you tend to hold these biases that I'm talking about. Okay. All right. So anyway, bottom line, given these incentives, economists should really expect misconceptions to last. Which people say, isn't that pretty depressing? Well, it's kind of depressing, but here's the upside of this. Just like with an alcoholic, step one is admitting you have a problem. All right. So similarly, step one with fixing democracy is admitting that there's a problem. Admitting that just because most people think something does not make it true, just because most people think something does not mean that it is true on average, and it's quite possible that a view can be popular for a very long time and simply be wrong. All right. So yes. Right. Well, I'd say, there's a few things I'd say here. First of all, if you just go down and take a look at public opinion and the policies that we have, there's a very strong tendency for the status quo to be what most people want. So if you go to, for example, the General Social Survey and just look at the distribution of public opinion on policy views, what you'll find is in almost every case, as long as the question is worded in a reasonably balanced way, the policy that the median person thinks we should have is the policy that we do have. The best counterexamples are actually foreign aid and immigration. Okay, so although even with immigration, I would say, does the median voter want to do what we would really have to do to stop immigration, which is build that Berlin Wall with automatic firing machine guns? I think a lot of people say, well, we don't want to go quite that far. There's that. Now, also, I would say, look, if you just look at what politicians actually do when they're trying to run for office, it is true they put a lot of money into their haircuts and their speech coaches and trying to look good and sound good. However, they also are very desperately trying to find out what most people think and to say exactly that. Okay, so there's a reason why politicians put a lot of money into public opinion polling, which is that is what allows them to say what most people think. And they know that they want to get elected, they basically need to say what most people hear, or what most people want to hear. So I say again, it would be amazing if politicians put all this effort into trying to match what the public wants. If it really didn't matter, and it really, really the best thing would just be to get plastic surgery. So plastic surgery can be good too, right? In a way, I say, if people voted purely on the basis of looks, things would be a lot better, because I don't think there's any reason to think that good looking politicians would have especially bad views. Right. Yeah. Oh, pardon? Mm-hmm. Oh, right, right. Which I do believe. Certainly I believe that's a factor, right? As to whether that will give you a really good prediction. That's hard to believe. And especially if you just take a look at what the guys in Congress look like. I would wonder, why hasn't Hollywood taken over DC? Why do they have so many not only ugly but also uncharismatic guys there? So I'll say that's a problem for all theories. I don't know, but certainly if looks were the key, then the guys who are there could easily be kicked out of office by somebody else. So I believe looks are a factor, but there's got to be a lot else going on. Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. So what I'd say is there's an enormous difference between public opinion polling and betting markets. He asked about the implications of, for example, online betting markets, as it relates to the wisdom of crowds. So here I'd say there's actually a huge difference between public opinion polling and betting markets, which is in public opinion, you ask everyone whether they have any idea what's going on or not, and you don't charge them for errors. On the other hand, with betting markets, the people who go in are generally the people who know more than people, know more than other people. And if you go in thinking you know a lot and you don't, you start losing money. And on the other hand, if you go in and you actually start doing well, you actually start making more money, which you can then go and reinvest, and you actually can become an especially influential player. So basically, in terms of something in a betting market, there, this point that I was making where being wrong is costless is no longer true. In a betting market, you actually do have to pay for being wrong, which at minimum means that people who are wrong just drop out. They may not admit that they're wrong, but you can actually try this in conversation when someone says, I'm absolutely sure that Hillary will lose. something that some guy at a book club told me a few months ago, and I tried to make him bet me on the spot. And I said, look, if you're sure, then you should give me 101 odds. And it's just free money for you, because if you're actually sure, then then my dollar against your 100, it's a free dollar. So why don't you take it? Right. So, of course, the guy just declined to bet. Right. And he said, why should I bet you 101 when I could go to betting markets and get better? But I know the guy didn't go home and bet on the betting markets either. He just wanted to be a blowhard and claim to know the future with certainty, even though he wasn't willing to put his money up. So anyway, one of the main things that I disagree with is Sir Wiki is equating, basically just asking people with betting markets, where betting markets really are something where you pay for being wrong, and there's a very strong incentive to get it right, and people who are wrong tend to avoid the market, and so they effectively are silenced. Whereas when you're just doing public opinion polling, everyone counts the same, and there's no cost to being wrong, so it's much less reliable. So in terms of betting markets, on almost any question, if the betting market says something, I believe it. Yes. Mm-hmm. 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 All right. I see. I'd be happy to. So, yes, in terms of the questions being too narrow, I mean, one thing I say, as I said at the beginning, most Americans will say the economy is the number one issue facing the country. So if it's a narrow issue, it's a big narrow issue. The other thing is that I wanted to focus on the area where I actually had some expertise. This does not mean that people are actually better in other areas. For example, foreign policy, I'm more than happy to think that the American public is just as screwed up about foreign policy as it is about economics. There's a political scientist named Scott Althaus who's doing a new book on public opinion and war, where he has some very interesting findings that could have made it into the book, but it came out too late. So here's one. The rally around the flag effect, which is that declaring wars can suddenly make wars really popular, is absolutely true. Enormous evidence in favor of it. Basically, by declaring war, you can make it 20 or 30 percentage points more popular overnight. Okay, which, again, you could have some really convoluted theory about how people know the president is so smart that when he declares war, must be a great idea. But, or actually not declaring war, but entering war. However, I'm skeptical of that. You also have some other interesting results about how basically people, support for war starts falling off even when the war is going about as well as should have been expected initially. Now, in terms of the policy implications, let's see. Elitist, I'm willing to accept that charge. Yes, it is elitist now for the crypto fascist. So again, what I do in the book is divide up policy reforms into two groups. One suffering from a catch-22 and one's not suffering from a catch-22. So the catch-22 is there's many things that many changes you could do that I think would improve things. However, it would take majority approval to get them to happen. And on my own theory, the majority will never approve them. Okay, so those I mostly put forward just to expand people's imaginations, stretch their minds, get them thinking. The other ones, they do not suffer from a catch-22. Step one is just getting the public to admit it has a problem, right? So, just saying, look, just because most people think something does not mean it's a good idea. Improving education, this is something that I have some power to do because I am an educator. So I can try to improve my classes. I can go and exhort other economists to do the same. In terms of more elitist things, I suggest greater reliance on experts. And again, there's a number of areas where we already do defer to experts to an unusually large extent. So, for example, the Federal Reserve is basically run by economists. And in the U.S., very few people have much of a problem with this. Okay. Yes. Hmm. 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 If you could do it, I think it would be a good idea. I don't think there's any chance of that happening. Actually, there's something interesting in Britain. Until 1949, college grads got two votes in Britain. And I think that would be, I think that would give us better policy, and I have no principled objection to it. Again, am I going to go and put up a sign saying give two votes to college graduates and think that anyone's going to listen to me? No. I put this in the book just because I wanted to make the point of people are so dogmatic about democracy that when you say something like this, they do start throwing around words like crypto fascist instead of saying, well, why is that such a bad idea? Or something much more moderate. Here's the suggestion of instead of encouraging people to vote, suggest, look, if you don't know what's going on, you would be doing us a favor if you did not vote. This is a very, I fail to see how anyone could object to this. Yet, of course, most people do, but yes. Mm-hmm. from the people reading your newsletter. Ah, all right. No, fair enough. Now, you know, interesting case, you know, Greg Mankiw, who used to have a column for Fortune. The one column that Fortune refused to run was the one where he said, if you don't know what's going on, it would be doing us a favor if you would abstain. And that was, you know, and they just said, look, this is so horrible and inflammatory. We're not running this. Again, I mean, if there's a bunch of doctors in a room talking about brain surgery and one of them says, I don't know what's going on. You say, look, it doesn't matter where you cut, but cut. We were saying, what? you may say, look, all right, best thing of all would be if you would inform yourself. But if you're not going to inform yourself, wouldn't the responsible thing be just honest saying, you know, I don't really know much about this? And again, of course, there's also middle ground, which is if you don't know much about a subject, do not vote on the basis of that subject. Right. So if people who knew nothing about economics but knew something about other fields would just say, look, I'm just not going to pay any attention to candidates' economic proposals because I don't know anything about those. In that case, that would mean that candidates would have to appeal to people who did know something about economics, and policy in that area would improve just, you know, not even by not voting, but just by remaining agnostic about things that you don't know about, which, again, you know, saying remain agnostic about things that you don't know about seems to be a counsel of just common decency. I mean, again, it's possible that when people talk about the economy, they just mean the stock market. I think they also mean, output, employment, so on. I think your deeper question is just, how much of this is values and how much of this is facts? So, in the data set that I have, the questions are basically factual questions. So there you can see that purely on factual questions, there are large gaps. And again, if people care about outcomes at all, then when you have these factual gaps, that if you were to go and get rid of that gap, that would move people in economist direction. Now, there also are a number of questions that specifically get at this. For example, there was a survey done by Gallup a few years ago where they actually randomly asked people one of two questions. One is, should we raise the minimum wage? The other was, should we raise the minimum wage if it would increase low-skilled employment? Okay, so the only difference between these two questions is that one added on a hypothetical factual difference. And raising the minimum wage generally has support of about 80 to 90% of the U.S. population. And the survey found that when you didn't mention the employment consequences, but mentioning these possible employment consequences made support drop to about 40%. So this is something where, again, you may say, well, 40% may want to have it regardless of the consequences. Although even there, the proposed consequence was quite mild. It just said if there is an effect on low-skilled employment. It didn't say massive or anything like that. And again, I think there are a number of other cases where you can isolate that purely changing people's factual views would change their policy views. I guess another interesting example is support for the war in Iraq. You can just by changing three views about Iraq, like whether there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, whether Saddam Hussein was responsible for the 9/11 attacks, one other thing. Basically, if people change their minds on those things, their support for the Iraq war drops by an enormous amount. Okay, so it's, again, you may say support about for the Iraq war is partly values, partly facts, but a lot of it is facts. Let's see, how much time do we have? I know we're not supposed to go over 2 minutes. Okay, so I guess time for one or two more questions. Let's see, someone who hasn't asked a question before, are you there, please? Mm-hmm. Right, the political brain, my big competitor. Emotion is very important, but emotion can guide you in a couple ways. One of the main things is emotion leads you to believe that the facts are the way that you want them to be. Right, so emotion is what leads you to think, look, we don't like Saddam Hussein, and we don't like the World Trade Center bombing, and then I have bad feelings about both of them. Therefore, Hussein did the World Trade Center bombing, or think of the case of foreigners. I don't like people in China. Therefore, they're responsible for what's going wrong with our economy. Or I don't like Mexicans. Therefore, they're responsible for what's going wrong with their economy. I think a lot of this really is coming from an emotional level of just like, step one, I don't like them. Therefore, they are the scapegoat for what's going wrong. Mm-hmm. Again, it's certainly possible. The actual public opinion data on that is that in general, whether or not you have health insurance has very little to do with whether you support national health insurance. But I mean, I bet you're emotional. I think people get emotional about the state of the country more than about their own particular circumstance. So do we have time for one more question or should we just... Okay, well, thanks everyone for coming. I'm shocked at how many people were here. So thank you.